Christopher Knight has worked in advertising and marketing for more than 30 years, and until recently he was the chairman of an English advertising agency called Paradigm, which was named the country's advertising agency of the year. That was in 2000. He now divides his time between marketing consultancy and historical research, and Christopher has written 4 books to date, co-authored with Robert Lomas. He has invested 7 years conducting research into the origins of Freemasonic rituals. His interest in Freemasonry began in 1976 when he joined a local lodge simply to find out what these men did behind their closed doors. Over the next couple of years, he realized that nobody understood what the rituals were all about or where they could have come from. Over a quarter of a century later, he has tracked the origins of these rituals down to prehistoric stonemasons in the British Isles. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast, Christopher Knight. Hi, Christopher. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Hi there.
My pleasure indeed. Freemasonry. A lot of people have called this program wanting to know what this means. What is the organization? There are some people, Christopher, who believe that they are sinister. There are other people who say, no, they're not. We thought we'd talk with you about this. First, what are Freemasons? Who are they?
Well, that's a pretty hard thing to define because, as you just said, Freemasons themselves don't know what they really are in terms of their origins and history. And the rituals that are conducted are very strange and bizarre, and they aren't self-explanatory either. So Freemasons aren't quite sure what they are themselves. As to them being sinister, I've spent a lot of years investigating it since 1976, in fact, and I've found absolutely nothing that's sinister. And I've no interest in saying something that I don't find to be true. It's, you know, it just isn't the case. It is completely benign. There's a lot of work for charity, a lot of positives, and I've never come across any serious negatives at all.
Okay. By the way, I got to tell you, if I didn't know better, I'd swear I was talking to the actor Russell Crowe. You sound just like him. Anybody ever tell you that before?
No, I've not heard that one. No.
You do. You do. Thought we'd bring out some lines from the Gladiator movies. I mean, incredible the way you sound. You joined to become a Freemason, as I was saying, in 1976. Were you that puzzled by them to join, or were you just doing it for fun? What happened?
Yeah, it was just curiosity. I knew one or two old guys that were Freemasons. I was in my 20s, and I thought, you know, I've heard negative things said about them, that they're a sinister organization, they've got these strange rituals. I would wish I knew what they got up to. I don't think they could be too bad. Most these people I knew wouldn't be members, because they seem to be upstanding members of the community. So I thought, well, I'll just join, because that's the best way of finding out. And if it's really crazy or boring, I can just leave. So I joined quite simply to find out what they'd do. And having joined, I realized that they didn't know. So that's where my curiosity grew rather than anything else. So that's taken me through to today, to spend virtually all of my spare moments and more besides investigating the origins of the rituals that they use.
And Freemasonry is all over the world. It's not just restricted to the United States or England or anything like that.
Well, anywhere, really, where the British Empire in its days of glory went. I mean, it's huge in India, for example, but everywhere across the world where the British Empire or the Commonwealth had once existed. Of course, the United States is the biggest place now for Freemasonry. But, of course, it's shrinking globally, as all fraternal organizations are.
When I was younger and I would hear the word Masons or Freemasonry, I always confused it with bricklayers, people who I thought it was a union for bricklayers or some organization for that. Yet, as you mentioned, that there was some tie-in to prehistoric stonemasons in the British Isles. So there's got to be some tie-in there.
Well, there certainly is. I mean, there are the official sort of history of Freemasonry, which goes back to 1717 officially to London in England. They, for political reasons, say they can't go back further. They don't know what happened before then, but probably it was something to do with guilds of stonemasons, medieval stonemasons, and they leave it at that because the rituals are all based around the idea of working stone and building buildings and the plans of the temple, particularly King Solomon's temple. and the skills of, in allegoric terms, of the stonemason. So there's a very clear connection between it and stoneworkers. So you could, I could understand why you were potentially thinking that it was a trade union or something for builders. That is what they say is the case, but it's nothing like as simple as that, and it goes back a great deal further than the Middle Ages.
Did they have any special powers or gifts with just some of the things they did or the rituals they performed?
Well, the rituals that they perform are absolutely astronomical in that they represent the seasons of the year, the movements of the planets, particularly planet Venus, and alignments, the winter solstice, summer solstice, and all of the movements of the people and the things that they say are connected to ancient awareness of the skies, as well as building in stone. But a lot of it they don't today recognize as that, although it can be quickly analyzed and shown to be connected to astronomy. It doesn't appear to be, in the actual words, if you listen to the simple words used today, there doesn't appear to be a great deal in it above and beyond that, but there most certainly is. It's a memory of literally a Stone Age tradition of science and religion, where the two things were once the same thing.
Are they part of a bigger picture for, let's say, a one-world government, as some people believe they may be?
Absolutely not. Two things that are forbidden to be discussed within Freemasonry and are of no interest to Freemasonry are religion and politics. There's some silly things said about one world governments and so on. In actual fact, in the United Kingdom, across here in England and Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, it is Freemasonry always has been, for the last few hundred years, involved with the royal family. So it's very royalist, but in actual fact, Freemasonry is very, very democratic, and one reason why it grew fiercely in the United States, obviously the founding fathers of the United States were more likely to be Freemasons than not, from George Washington downwards, so it is fiercely sort of independent and democratic.
Well, the fact that these organizations have grown in great numbers, and let's use the United States for a moment, there are all kinds of things that the organizations do, and a lot of them are charitable for people.
Yeah.
They raise money. They do very special things for kids and children.
Yeah.
There is a hierarchy, though, that some say might have some knowledge of things or do things that the other members don't have any idea. Would that be true?
No, in a word. the hierarchy, particularly the ones hierarchy that would probably be referred to in the United States is possibly, if you say someone's a 33rd degree Freemason, the Scottish Rite, for instance. That is an American invention. It isn't at the heart of Freemasonry. In other countries there are up to 96 degrees in some forms of Freemasonry. But the real important parts of Freemasonry are in the lesser degrees, and the idea that individual Freemasons don't know what's going on because they're not senior enough is sort of nonsense, because I found the more senior people are, the less likely they are to know anything significant.
How many members are there worldwide? What do you think?
It's still measured in the millions, but dwindling fast, of course. So I don't know. Maybe 4 or 5 million in the world. But it's very difficult to know that because there is no central register. It isn't really as organized as people think. Even in England, we really just don't know how many members there are for sure.
Was there anything in the organization that you saw, that you heard, that you found to be strange or weird or anything like that?
Well, the rituals themselves are incredibly weird. And that is the important part. And the people that are conducting these rituals don't understand why they're doing them. And one of the reasons why Freemasonry is thought to be secret, which it isn't, you know, there are just a tiny few words and other elements that are actually officially secret. The rest is not. It is open public material. But most Freemasons say, oh, it's secret, I can't talk about it. basically because the rituals that they perform are so bizarre, so strange. And somebody says, you do what? You roll your trouser leg up, you bare your breast, you walk around with a blindfold on, you repeat these strange words. Why do you do that? And they have to then say, well, I don't know. Of course, that doesn't sound too smart.
No, but the question is why do they do that?
Well, they don't know. They do it because they join, and everybody else is doing it, and they're wearing strange aprons and garb. And it seems like a good idea at the time. And certainly everything they're told about, as you say, is charitable and outgoing.
Sure.
So they go along with it. But they can't talk about it outside because it just sounds so weird. So they're going along with it for very superficial reasons, if you like. But in actual fact, if you want to protect information and pass it down generations, hundreds and thousands of years, if you teach someone a ritual and you say, you must not deviate from that, you must remember those words perfectly, people can pass on information from father to son to grandson and down without losing the information. They don't necessarily have to understand it, but they can pass it on intact until it reaches some point where it can be understood.
These,
message in the bottle.
These rituals that are performed, does anybody ever get hurt by them?
No. Not well. not truly hurt. There is, in the third degree, which is the most important ritual, where the candidate is symbolically murdered and laid in their tomb and then resurrected to the light of Venus rising in the morning. In Scotland, for instance, they get a bit vigorous sometimes with the simulation of the murder, and people can be sort of winded a little bit, but that's as bad as it gets. No, there's no genuine harm in this at all.
I had heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, that even Jesus may have been a Freemason. Is that true?
Well, in my first book, The Hiram Key, I sort of made reference to that, not in a literal sense, but the rituals used by Freemasons today would have been, in my opinion, known to him. Certainly the key ritual of third degree would have been known to him, but Freemasonry didn't exist until well over 1,000 years later in terms of it being called Freemasonry, but that didn't mean the ritual didn't exist. It's just been passed along, and in its current form it's used by Freemasons, but it's been used, or a number of these rituals have been used, in my opinion, for 5 and maybe 6,000 years. And there is good reason to believe that the man we remember as Jesus Christ was a member of a high priesthood that was aware and practiced these rituals.
Why do you think some people think that they're up to something?
Well, very simply, because any organization that is clearly powerful and has significant people, both living and dead, as members, has had or does have, and then doesn't tell anybody what they do, well, you're going to think the worst, aren't you?
Oh, sure, most people do.
A crazy period when they wouldn't speak about it. And I advised United Grand Lodge of England, which is considered to be the world's preeminent Grand Lodge, to talk about it, to open up. And they've done that. Because it's when you don't speak that people don't trust you. And, Freemasonry is fully responsible for the negative press they get.
I mean, but you are 100% sure that they're not up to something.
Absolutely, 100% sure. I mean, over the years, I've wondered, but I've spoken to, grandmasters in different countries and different states at length, and there is absolutely nothing. And in fact, the really important material within Freemasonry is not known to them. So, I'm 100% in my own mind sure that there is nothing in it at all. And in fact, in the UK here, every so-called wrongdoing attributed to Freemasonry that has been checked out has been found to be false.
Now, you've heard of course, the Illuminati. We all believe that this organization and groups of certain people are out there for their own well-being and glory and everything else. Could there be a crossover between Freemasonry and that?
The biggest weakness of Freemasonry is that it's made up of human beings who are less than perfect, and it's not improbable that there are or have been senior Freemasons who are members of other organizations that are less desirable, so we say. Benjamin Franklin was possibly a case in point, who was a very active Freemason, but he also belonged to some rather dubious other organizations. Not necessarily Illuminati as such, but yes, but I mean, if you go to any golf club, you might find people that are actively working together for some bigger goal. You know, wherever people meet, there will be minor conspiracies of some kind, I'm sure. But it isn't any formal part of Freemasonry. If it does happen, it's just because they are important people.
And you write about the prehistoric monuments that they built were created and made with incredible accuracy and using measurements. How was all that possible in that era?
Well, that's the big point of my current book that's just come out, that my co-author and myself started looking at what is known as the megalithic yard. Now, 5,000 or 6,000 years ago, people were living in the Stone Age in the British Isles and Western Europe. And everybody thinks of them as being sort of Fred Flintstones. And the evidence that they've left behind them are stone circles and so on, like Stonehenge and far older ones, in fact. And they look very rough. But in actual fact, a professor of engineering from Oxford University, Professor Alexander Tarmuk, spent nearly 50 years surveying over 1,000 of these sites from northern Scotland down to the French coast, found that they used a unit of measurement that was so accurate you can't see, you know, the difference is tiny, 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 and absolutely perfect. And that's a big, big problem, because they were working to tolerances that we could not achieve in any building now with our laser technology. They were working to accuracies that a Swiss watchmaker couldn't work to. How come? You know, and that was the start of our most recent investigation, that there was clearly something wrong. If Alexander Tom was right, and a lot of archaeologists, or the majority of archaeologists, say he must be wrong because it's so strange and seemingly impossible. So we set out to try and find out what this unit of measurement was, where it had come from, and how they reproduced it. And we succeeded in doing that. And that then opened up a whole treasure chest of information. And what we find is there is a complete system of super science that was in use 5,000 years ago that we can outline completely. You know, we're not just alluding to it, we can lay it out. And it makes our modern systems look stupid, quite frankly.
And does that cross over, for example, into what the Sumerians knew and did in those days? Because you have some knowledge of that as well.
Very much so. The Sumerians are the people that lived in ancient Iraq, effectively, 5,000 years ago. And the ancient Egyptians both took their mathematics and their geometry and their approach to science from this system that was in use before that in the British Isles. And we can track in absolute detail how they used the same approach and technology. And in their oldest records in ancient Egypt and in the land of Sumer, they actually state that these strange people came in from they knew not where, who stood on the side of their civilization and taught them about philosophy, about music, about mathematics, about geometry, that they attribute all of the knowledge of their civilizations, which sprang out of nowhere, to these incoming people that taught them. So where did these people come from? Well, we're not saying it's necessarily the people from the British Isles, but there was obviously a group of super advanced people who were at least teaching the people in the British Isles first.
Well, let's talk about that when we come back, Christopher, where you think the super advanced group may have come from. His website, by the way, is civilization1.com. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Christopher Knight. Christopher, let's go back a little bit and talk about the Sumerians, who have had an incredible history on this planet. I mean, if you look at what some people have written, Zechariah Sitchin and his interpretation, for example, of old Sumerian tablets, he believes in an extraterrestrial connection. Did you find any of that out during any of your work and research?
In terms of an extraterrestrial connection?
Yes.
No.
Okay.
Our approach, my colleague and myself, is to map down what we find and see. We are dealing with sort of hard facts which build up into an alarming picture. And then, having laid them out, we step back and say, how could this all be? Because clearly the standard explanation of prehistory is wrong. It's quite simply wrong. It's shot down. The paradigm of prehistory is gone. With this new information that we've brought out in our new book, and it's testably, checkably so. Anyone can check it with a calculator. It's that simple. The facts are hard, but we've fired this sort of silver bullet into the heart of this existing paradigm, which leaves us with the problem that there was a super advanced group of people, for sure, absolute certain. Then the question is, who were they? Where did they get this knowledge? You know, that's for people to sort of answer and say, well, it could only have come from extraterrestrials, or some people may say it came from angels because there really is a God. They could say those things. It's for each person at the minute to sort of look at the available evidence and start to work out for themselves.
Well, do you think it's unusual that they had this high gifted knowledge?
Well, it's so far in advance of anything we've got. And
You mean it's more advanced than what we have right now?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
My God.
I mean, even what we've laid out to date, we've probably only scratched the surface, makes our system look childlike. It is utterly startling. And we are not, this is not a theory. These are cold facts that are checkable. They had knowledge then that is equal to ours now, but the way they used that knowledge, the system they created about it, is so sophisticated that we've sort of reinvented it over time. We think we're so smart now, but in actual that every day we get smarter, but it's not like that. Clearly, there was a time when people knew just as much as we knew now, but they used it in such a smarter way. And it's hard to know how some of this knowledge could exist without spaceflight, basically. I mean, we're not saying they had to have spaceflight, but we can't, as non-specialists in spaceflight, we can't imagine how on earth they could have had some of the knowledge that they did have without it.
What about this theory, Christopher? What if we had a past civilization that was so advanced technologically and knowledge-wise, and then something happened? There is talk that geologists have seen remnants of nuclear explosions in those regions. They see glass, for example, deep down within the planet. So maybe it's possible we had civilizations that were more advanced than where we are today, earthbound, and that somehow they did something or some calamity took them all in. Possible?
Entirely possible for a number of reasons, and I'm a skeptic. This is the sort of thing I wouldn't have discussed a few years ago, but now I have to do. I mean, the new book is called Civilization One for the reason that there was a Civilization One that went before all that followed. That just has to be so. Now, whether they were a larger civilization such as we've got in the Western world today, I doubt. They may have been very, very small in number, but very advanced. The question then is, as you suggest, were they wiped out? Well, we know that there have been major disasters. 9,000 years ago, there was a global flood, such as described in Sumerian legend and described in the Bible as the Noah's flood. So possibly they existed and they were wiped out. And another possibility, which when I was first told it by a group of people connected to the space program, NASA space program, I thought was completely potty, but now I'm not so sure, and that is that this advanced group existed, and they still exist, and they are still 5,000 years ahead of us. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but there is certainly no reason why it shouldn't be so.
Well, it is fascinating indeed. Now, the research that you've done to come across some things like this and all that, I mean, how far do you dig and where do you dig?
This is a sort of forensic approach to history. Archaeology typically sort of goes and digs up and looks for artifacts, whether they're bits of human remains or bits of daily life, pots and swords, weapons, and then tries to make sense of how these people lived, which is entirely sensible and valid. It looks at their rubbish heaps to see what they were eating, and that's one technique. But we've taken a forensic look at measuring systems, because we started with this unit of measure that Professor Tom identified, the megalithic yard, which shouldn't exist. I mean, it's crazy. And so we went down that route of looking at measurements of time, of length, of capacity, of weight, and then studied how those have evolved in the world. And what we found is the further you go back, the more integrated it all is, not more chaotic. And we in fact found that modern measurement systems like the pound and the pint have been in use for over 5,000 years, exactly as they exist today in the British Isles. The pint has been changed slightly in the United States to make it the same as the pound, but that was a deliberate action. And we couldn't believe, because the pound and the pint are absolutely megalithic. That is, they belong to the Stone Age, which is crazy. But yet we found other people in history have noted this ancient super system of measurement, including Thomas Jefferson, when he started to invent a new system for the fledgling United States.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody that takes the time to look at it will find there's a big problem, because the further we go back, the smarter it all gets, not the more chaotic. And the more integrated, you look at measurement systems from out the world, and they're all coming from the same place. And they integrated. Time, for instance, does not, in modern-day terms, we're still using the Sumerian system of time with 60 seconds to the minute and 60 minutes to the hour. That's the ancient Iraqi system. The second belongs to them.
And as you well know, ancient Iraqi is indeed Sumerian, right?
Absolutely, the same thing. Ironically, with where we're at today. So what we have today is a system where we use the decimalized system in base 10. So we're counting in base 10 for all our normal measurements. But when it comes to time, we're sort of working in the Sumerian base 60 system, which is very, very strange. And the second of time is not the same thing as a second of arc in geometry, because there are 360 degrees in a circle. There are 60 minutes to a degree and 60 seconds to a minute. But in terms of the planet, a second of arc has got no connection with a second of time. Originally, it did. In the megalithic system, they were exactly the same thing.
Well, but there's no way prehistoric people would have come up with this on their own.
Well, that's the problem, because archaeologists rejected what Tom said because it seemed impossible. But he had the data, and they just said, well, you must have made a mistake in your data. Now, we've got far, far more data, because we've done comparisons with the Egyptians, the Sumerians, and the system used in the British Isles. And they all used exactly the same technique. And there are ancient records from the Sumerian civilization which bears it all out, absolutely. So you can't poo-poo it. You can't say it isn't true. It is not a mistake. And then you've got to start to say, how can they have had this? It just is so far removed from everything else we know about these people.
What is all the different Freemasonry rites, by the way? I mean, you've got the Scottish Rite, and you've got all these others.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, it's largely down to sort of politics and the process of time. That in the British Isles, Freemasonry developed really in Scotland. And it was brought down to London when King James VI of Scotland became King James I of England at the beginning of the 1600s, 1601. But the York Rite already existed. So the London form of Freemasonry was taken sort of from Scotland. And then in the early 1700s, when Scotland started invading England, it was not safe to say you were a Freemason, because everyone knew it had got these Jacobite, these Scottish connections. So they had to, as they did in 1717, say, well, we just don't know where we came from, because it was politically necessary. And the York Rite was sort of pushed back as the London people started to present themselves as the authority. And in Scotland, they were getting on doing their own thing. Then it was growing in Ireland. And then it was, in the United States, for instance, there were some people from each of those backgrounds developing in the United States. So it's just the same rituals are at the heart of them all, but it's sort of changed into different political groupings, if you like, for political reasons.
The Freemasonry, the Sumerians, Knights Templar, do they fit into this?
Absolutely they do. It sounds very cozy and romantic, as though you're hoovering up everything that's a little bit exciting and interesting from history, but they're absolutely part of it. The rituals that are now used by Freemasonry, the core rituals, the really important ones, were once the rituals used by the Knights Templar, which were before that were taken from a Jewish priesthood that I firmly believe Jesus Christ was involved with, which was extremely ancient, which was taken from Canaanite ritual, which was taken from British ritual, from the Stone Age. So there is a continuum there, and it sort of went round in a big circle over thousands of years, and it's trackable. The evidence is very strongly there, but there was a resurgence of it when the Knights Templar were formed just after the First Crusade at the beginning of the 1100s, and they resurrected, if you like, these rituals and these processes that had been sort of dormant since the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD, relatively shortly after the death of Jesus Christ. But they themselves were then destroyed in 1307, so they only existed for around 200 years. But they sort of went underground, and they went to Scotland after they were arrested by the powers of the Pope, because in that time Robert the Bruce was excommunicated, so it was a very safe place to go, and they had lots of lands in Scotland. And that's where Freemasonry then bubbled up through, and the first Grand Master of Freemasonry was a member of the Sinclair family, who were at the heart of Templarism in Scotland from the beginning. So that is where they fit in.
The push for Freemasonry today, is it much different than it was then?
Very much different. The rituals that they had then were very powerful, and they belonged to this strange group of effectively monks who were not regular Christians in any way, that they deviated from the only form of religion that was allowed, which was from the Pope, the directive of the Pope in Rome.
Were these Jesuits?
They weren't. They were Jewish, basically, but they Jesus Christ was considered to be very important and part of them, but they were not Christian in any normal sense. Whereas Freemasonry today is, by and large, entirely Christian, but of course there are Jewish members and there are Muslim members, and as long as you believe in God, you are allowed to become a Freemason. But because it belongs to the Western world, and the Western world is largely Christian, most Freemasons will be Christians.
What do they mean with all these things about I'm a 32nd degree Mason, or what does that mean?
Well, that's the Scottish Rite, for instance, and it goes up to the 33rd degree.
All right.
Interestingly,
I was close. I was off by one degree.
But interestingly, I'm not sure if there's a direct connection, but the land of summer, Iraq, is 33 degrees north as a latitude. But I'm not sure there's necessarily a connection there. But most of those degrees are either inventions or relatively recent inventions, or so tampered with. Some of them have been, in my view, deliberately Christianized, and they were pre-Christian. In fact, they were pre-Jewish. They're so ancient, some of them, but they've been changed to fit into the niceties of the modern world. But the 33rd degree itself is not particularly meaningful.
The biggest thing facing Freemasonry today, is there anything about this organization? And I assume you're still one, aren't you?
Yes, I must admit I'm not entirely active these days, because I've just so busy doing the research into the subject that I don't physically get there. But I give talks in lodges and so on.
It's one of those things that once you're in, you're never out?
That's correct, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're a Freemason by name, you're a Freemason forever sort of thing, unless you're actually thrown out for wrongdoing. So, yes, but not that it means much, really. It's just by name.
Is there anything that they're doing today that is particularly disturbing to you?
Not really. I think there's a great deal of good. I think particularly in your country, it's much more healthy in that the lodges tend to work very strongly, in my experience, with their own communities and give to their own communities.
That's true.
And then there's the Shriners that, as you touched upon, provide hospitals for helping children from all over the world, which is a wonderful organization which I'm proud to belong to. Doesn't exist in England, possibly largely because we have a national health system which is supposedly free to everybody anyway. So there's a great deal of good comes out. The bad is really when they, to me, play power games such as the United Grand Lodge in England. They think themselves very important, and they strut about, and they lose sight of the whole thing, and they give themselves very important-sounding names and wear outfits that look like Admiral of the Fleet, and, you know, and it's the pomposity. It's got out of hand, really. But that's in my view, that's as bad as it's got. It isn't very well organized or run, and, you know, if any company, you know, private company was run as badly, it would go bankrupt. They've squandered huge amounts of money in this country and made very bad business decisions. They're pretty incompetent, and if they were, as some people suggest, organizing some sort of Illuminati-style world takeover, well, God help everybody else, because these guys aren't that sharp.
Well, you know, I have seen some of the incredible buildings they own, for example, here in this country. I mean, they're huge.
Yeah. I mean, times have changed. Obviously, these days, people have a lot of spare time. You can sit and watch hundreds of channels of TV, or you can go out to bowling, or you can go out to restaurants, cinemas. There's so much to do, and sports clubs to belong to, or whatever you want to do. But, you know, you go back just 50 years, certainly 100 years, and there wasn't much to do in a community. And if you just didn't want to go down to the local bar or the local pub, you would become a Freemason, probably. And so it grew because of lack of, perhaps, competition.
That's probably true. Christopher, stay with us. We're going to keep you another hour, and we're going to open up the phone lines, give everybody an opportunity that they may have questions about Freemasonry. And by the fast blasts I'm getting on my computer, they sure are. So we'll be back in a moment. Your phone calls. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM with Christopher Knight and your phone calls. Christopher, of all the work you've done on this subject, is there any one thing that fascinates you, that perplexes you more than anything?
Well, it keeps on moving. The research I've been doing over the many years doesn't stop. The more you look, the more it opens up. And currently, I'm confronted with this problem we've already discussed of how on earth could this super science have existed in the Stone Age. And that's the problem I'm currently working on. My research is involved with trying to work out who these people were.
To the phones we go. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with Christopher Knight. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Christopher.
Hi there.
Hi. Last month, I was present at a funeral where the Messianic rites were given for the person that passed away. And let me say, not only was this person a Mason, he had received a Congressional Medal of Honor, okay? This man was in good standing in the community. And I'd known him, well, it was my dad. I knew him all my life, and I never knew that he was a Mason, you know. And like you said, Christopher, about the garb that they wear and the whole nine yards, there was the Grandmaster present and three other guys. And he had a necklace, big metal necklace on with a lot of the different symbols, the apron. the thing that got me about it is that on the apron they have the all they had the all-seeing eye of the Illuminati on there, and that kind of confused me a little bit. And a lot of the stuff that they had to say was very nice. You know, he presented an evergreen leaf explaining that this is the spirit of the man, you know, that goes back to the Creator. And I was a little distraught, but it was nice. It was very nice, but then again, it was kind of pagan in a way. I don't know how else to explain that, because at the end of each verse, they would all say, "So smote it be." Okay, and then they laid the apron on the coffin along with the evergreen and everything. It was very respectable. My dad also received the 21-gun salute. It was beautiful. But I heard you say it didn't have anything to do with the Illuminati's, and I was wondering why the Grand Master had the all-seeing eye along with other symbols on his apron.
Mm-hmm. There isn't a big problem there. I mean, that's a very ancient, very powerful sort of symbol. I mean, if you look on the dollar bill, there's an all-seeing eye. Its association with the Illuminati is the crazy bit, because no one knows if the Illuminati is real or not. So who knows what their symbols are? That symbol is extremely ancient, and it's used by Freemasons and it's used by others. It's on George Washington's apron. You don't suspect George Washington of being a bad guy. It's just an ancient symbol that represents the fact that you cannot escape the gaze of God. That's all it means.
We hope that's all it means, huh, Christopher?
Yeah, but different people can use certain symbols. I mean, the swastika, for instance, is an ancient Arabic symbol, but it was abused and misused by
the Nazis.
A group in Germany in the 1930s and 40s.
So true.
It doesn't make it an evil symbol.
Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast with Christopher Knight. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Alan. Calling from Kansas, driving down the road here tonight.
Hi, Alan. Go ahead.
Hey, question. A month or so ago on, you had a guy talking about Atlantis and some information that was taken to Scotland or Ireland where there was real intelligent, supposedly an intelligent group there. Could this and the Sumerians that he was talking about earlier, could this somehow be connected, tied in?
I don't know if you can rule that out, Christopher. Is that possible?
Well, it's difficult to rule things out, but you've got to look at time periods. Certainly, Ireland, for instance, was a repository of knowledge sort of in the first century AD, but we're talking about a lot earlier than that. In terms of Atlantis, I don't believe that was ever a single place. I think that's just a reference to this early group that may have been in many places. So it's difficult to pin it down in terms of time and geography.
Was this seriously now, in terms of its tentacles worldwide? I mean, was it in Greece? Was it in Italy? Was it in Europe?
We've got to deal with some pretty heavy-duty information that's coming out from science today. I mean, entirely respectable academics, leading academics, like Lord Renfrew in the United Kingdom, are saying that as recently as 15,000 years ago, everybody on the planet spoke the same language. Everybody, whether you were an Australian Aborigine or if you were a South American Indian.
Right.
Now, how do you have a global language without global communications?
I don't know.
There's something wrong.
When you joined, tell us a little bit about your initiation. Can you?
Yes, yeah, I can tell you a great deal, because, as I say, despite what many Freemasons believe, it is very clearly not secret, explicitly stated by the leading Grand Lodge of the world, the United Grand Lodge of England, that it is not secret, apart from a few words and a few actions, which I can't mention, which are totally unimportant anyway. In the first degree, I was brought into a room blindfolded, dressed in as a medieval heretic, with one side of my chest laid bare, one trouser leg rolled up, and a noose around my neck, and a dagger held to my heart. And then I was taken through a ritual where I was moved around the different symbolic parts of the land in terms of astronomy above, made to represent King Solomon's temple specifically, and went through various instruction and questioning and given certain information. Pretty strange. The second degree, somewhat similar, but no blindfold, which happened sort of 6 months later. And then 6 months later again, I was put to my third degree to be made a Master Mason, which is the arrival point, being a true Freemason, if you like. And that was really weird, because the door to the temple opens and it's in complete darkness. And there's just one shielded candle glimmering in the east on the Worshipful Master's pedestal. And then you go into the darkness, which is said to represent the darkness of death. And it's very spooky. And it's there where you die and are resurrected.
How old were you when this happened?
I was 26, 27 at that time. And you have to sort of surrender yourself to this. I mean, I suppose you could sort of run away screaming.
You stuck with it.
But I stuck with it because the reason I joined, I freely admit, is just I was nosy. I was curious.
Oh, sure. Were you initiated with
these strange rituals? Wow.
Were you initiated with other people or just by yourself?
By myself, yeah.
Okay. Because I'm wondering if you witnessed anybody running away, quitting.
No, because the strange thing about Freemasonry is there's no real output, because once you join, I said, okay, what is it we do? But all we do is bring in other people and give them the same rituals. So it just goes on doing the same rituals, and you need new candidates coming in all the time in order to have anything to do.
Where'd they get all their money, Christopher?
Well, people that join are, certainly used to be, probably a lot less so nowadays, relatively wealthy people who would pay their dues and give money to erect the buildings that the temples and that Freemasons use, and obviously to give money to charity for charitable purposes. But these days, they're more ordinary people, should we say, who have got mortgages and kids to educate and health bills and goodness knows what else. So it's a little harder than it used to be to maintain these fantastic buildings that you can see in the major cities of the world.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes.
How are you doing tonight?
Good.
Hello, Christopher.
Hi there.
Hi, this is Bill calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi, Bill.
I'm currently doing, I've been researching Freemasonry for about 8 years now. And I have read books such as The History of Freemasonry, The Lost Keys of Freemasonry, The Mystical Masonry, The Origin and Early History of Freemasonry, and also The Morals and Dogma, written by Albert Pike.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have to say, within all of my research, that I have found totally the opposite of what you're saying on the air tonight. I have quotes from these books, some of them 3 inches thick, many, many quote after quote, where they give reference to the Dragon of Light as Lucifer. And they explain in their books how that the lower orders of members of Freemasonry do not know what they are actually involved in. Not until you reach the 30th degree and above are you told the secret rites of the hierarchy. And only if you are one who understands all of the ancient symbols and what they truly represent, such as the so-called the pyramid with the eye, the original going back to Babylon and especially Egypt, that is the eye of Osiris, also known as the eye of Horus. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with Christianity. It's on the $1 bill, but along with that are also 50 other symbols that have nothing to do with Christianity whatsoever. They are all satanic and Luciferian symbols. And I just wondered if you could explain why you're giving this information of total opposite meaning of what Freemasonry is, because I've spent 8 years in very deep, deep, deep talking with Freemasons of the highest degree of 33 degrees who had to get out because they were being threatened, because they realized what they were involved in, and some of them had to move to other cities, other states, and other countries. And
all right. Well, let's get his response, if you want to respond to that, Christopher.
Yeah, that's pretty easy to respond to. I mean, 8 years isn't very long. I've been doing it many, many, many times longer than that. I've looked at these sort of charges. I mean, you mentioned Albert Pike. Well, he knew less than you, because he wrote nonsense, and he knew nothing. He was extremely junior, extremely young when he wrote this nonsense. The guy was a complete fruitcake. He's quoted by anti-Masons all over the place as though he was some sort of authority. He knew nothing. I've investigated with an open mind sort of some of these so-called charges, and that, to me, they appear bottomless. Now, we can agree to disagree, but there's just nothing in it. And you see quoted time and time again the same nonsense. And if people want to believe it, they will seek out the information that fits their prejudices. For and against, it's really difficult, but you've really got to try hard to take a balanced view. And at the end, you'll come out, hopefully, with something that is a reflection of what is really happening.
There are some, Christopher, who think you might be a disinformation person for the Freemasons.
Well, yes, because it's very easy to, you know, if you want to believe something, you can just say anyone that disagrees with me is a liar, which is a very easy way to reinforce your prejudices. But, I mean, the gentleman there said, Bill from Tucson said that the symbol is not Christian. Well, why should it be Christian? It's far older than Christianity. How can it be Christian when it's far, far older? Christianity is not the be-all and end-all. If you're a Christian, it's very important to you, but you can't change time. The story of Jesus Christ is far older than Jesus Christ. Every single part of it is ancient. He was reenacting out a model that has happened. I mean, Easter has been celebrated for thousands of years before Christ. Christmas was celebrated thousands of years before Christ. These symbols are pre-Christian. I mean, the lady earlier said that at her father's funeral, it seemed to be pagan. Well, all pagan means is pre-Christian nature worship. There's nothing wrong with that. They're sort of celebrating God as found in nature. So just because something isn't Christian doesn't make it wrong.
I'm also getting messages from people who are saying, who said Lucifer was evil?
Exactly. That's a very important point. Lucifer is not necessarily evil at all. It's quite the reverse. It's connected to light. It has become, since the Middle Ages, because the devil was more or less invented only 1,000 years ago, as such, and it's become meaningful. And people have created a symbolism around Lucifer. But it was once a very positive symbol. As the swastika was once a positive symbol.
Would you compare Lucifer and Satan as one of the same?
It's very complicated. I mean, if you start studying religion seriously and properly, you realize that Lucifer and the devil and God are one of the same. They were originally the same entity, but the negative side of God and the positive side of God, it's only as time has gone on and people have tried to rationalize and separate it, and they created this idea of an anti-god, if you like, as a some sort of entity. That Lucifer was the fallen angel who tried to become too wise. This is modern mythology that people give ridiculous sort of importance to.
Well, I'm telling you, that's a topic, though, that you'll never be able to get people to agree on.
Yeah, well, you can either do serious study or you can do lightweight study. But you will come to some strange conclusions if you just look at snapshots of things rather than the big context.
Let's go to our wildcard line. Welcome. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, George. This is Susan from Meridian, Mississippi.
Hi, Susan.
And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Christopher, and I don't know if you'll be able to answer it or not, but I wondered if you would discuss Eastern Star. Do you know much about them?
Sorry, say again?
The Easter Star?
Oh, the Eastern Star, yeah.
Eastern Star.
What? A little bit about them?
Well, as much as I know about them, it's quite simply that this is just Freemasonry for ladies. Mm-hmm. Most people are aware that Freemasonry is a male organization, but there is also female Freemasonry. To me, I think all Freemasonry should admit men and women alike, and I've said so for years. It's because that it came from a sort of monastic order, the Knights Templar, that it has been, in my view, male only. But the Eastern Star is where the ladies get involved in the United States. It's pretty much as aware only in the United States.
So around the rest of the world, they're not allowed in, huh?
Well, they're not allowed in. They don't. So there isn't a crossover. They're sort of parallel. There is female Freemasonry in the United Kingdom as well, and they are very well run. Arguably better run than male Freemasonry. They're much shrewder in their investments and much more selective in their candidates. So they're potentially, you know, sort of higher quality outfit, although very small.
How long have they been members?
I'm not sure. I think for 100 and some years. But they conduct exactly the same rituals as the men do. And I'm not knowing how capable ladies are sometimes of getting things just very perfect. I wouldn't be surprised if they're a great deal better at it than the men.
I guess we really don't know who is the individual who started this a long time ago, do we?
Well, it is a continuum. It really does go back nearly 6,000 years, and it goes through various manifestations. We can identify slots in time where something reasonably changed. You can't say, for instance, Lucifer is evil, because the symbol of Lucifer, you know, it's connected with Venus. It is, you know, from the astronomy religion. But it takes on different meanings at different times. We know that Freemasonry can't really be tracked down much before the 1400s.
Now stay with us, Chris. The book Civilization One, Christopher, how do people get it?
You can get it from your local bookstore, or you can visit our website, civilizationone.com.
All right, very good. Let's go back to the calls. East of the Rockies, it's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. Hey, Christopher. How are you doing?
Good. We're well. Thanks.
Calling from Columbus, Ohio, listening to 610 WTVN.
Super.
Question for you, Christopher.
Yep.
In my ancestry, it's purported that a gentleman by the name of Francis, who was a Freemason, lived somewhere in Scotland, had a castle somewhere, and he used to do all kinds of weird rituals and tie people up in his cellar and torture them. Did you run across this in any of your investigations?
No. Gosh, he sounds interesting.
Yeah, it does sound interesting. All right, well, that was my only question.
Okay, very good. Thanks.
Bye.
Were they ever in battle? I mean, the Knights Templar, they were tight. They were, you know, tight and tough people, weren't they?
Oh, gosh, yeah. I mean, they were famous. I mean, they just didn't give up in battle. They were monks, but they were warriors, and they were pretty terrifying. And there's a claim, which can't be absolutely proven, that they turned the Battle of Bannockburn, which was fought between England and Scotland, when the English were winning and the Scots were losing, and suddenly afterwards, there was a charge of Templars, which changed that battle. Whether it's true or not is not known, but if you came across them in battle, you were in trouble.
Next up, Wild Card Line, it's your turn. You're on the show. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
George, have I got you?
You got me.
Oh, great. This is Michael from Water Elite on 810 WGY, New York.
Go ahead.
Christopher, I got a question.
Yeah.
Have you ever studied whether, for example, you've been talking about the ancients and people that might have been so well developed, well back beyond our history, that they might have actually transitioned to 21 universes away and keep up only with those who are evolving spiritually and not really interested on politics and such?
I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but for sure, the Freemasonry itself is about the spiritual development of the individual rather than anything else. But as we go back in time, this was real heavy-duty science. I believe that as further you go back in time, science and religion were the same thing, and they sort of went in different directions. Relatively recently, but philosophy, religion, science should be the same thing. We're living in a strange period today when they've all been pushed into different corners.
Christopher, are you beginning to tip toward the possible theory then that there might have been some extra help with those people from thousands of years ago?
There absolutely. They say in their own records there was extra help, and all of the evidence stacks up and says what they wrote down was true. There was extra help coming in there. The question is,
where was
it coming from?
All right, in your opinion, I'm going to ask you to speculate, and if you don't want to, just don't, but where do you think it came from?
Well, there are a limited number of possibilities, and my approach is to keep your mind open.
All right, let's talk about those possibilities.
Okay.
One could be extraterrestrial, right?
Yep,
all right.
Absolutely.
The other could be a tremendously advanced Earth society at that time, right?
Yep.
And the other could be they stumbled into it, they lucked out, which is a possibility, as doubtful as it may sound. Is there any other?
There are probably two others, but can I just mention an extraordinary finding within our research?
By all means.
Changes things. Because everything we, Alan Butler, my co-researcher, myself, found was pretty bizarre. But we found that they mapped out the Earth 5,000 or 6,000 years ago by having 366 degrees in a circle and divided that into 60 minutes and then 6 seconds. And each of those was 366 megalithic yards wide at the equator. So this 366 works beautifully. But we then applied it to every planet and body in the solar system to see if there was some deeper rule about the way planets are. Absolutely nothing for anything apart from the moon and the sun. A megalithic second of arc on the moon is exactly, and I mean exactly, 100 megalithic yards. On the sun, it is exactly 40,000 megalithic yards. Whoever instigated this unit of measurement that Professor Tom identified in the Stone Age buildings had mapped in detail the moon and the sun. And you can't do that from the Earth.
Sounds like your views are changing, Christopher.
My views of kicking and screaming have had to change. I've spoken to audiences around the world who are believers in extraterrestrials, and I've had to, in a friendly way, disagree. Say, look, I find no evidence to support that. And you can believe it if you wish, but I will have to fall out on this one because I can't see it. Now I can potentially see it.
That's but pretty dramatic, then. For you?
For me, very. Yes. I actually had to think. The people that say there is a God and a creator God, maybe they've got a point. You know, was the sun, the earth, the moon, the whole solar system designed for us? Because if Jupiter wasn't exactly where it was, there wouldn't be life on Earth. If the moon wasn't exactly the size that it is and the density that it is and the position it is, there would be no life on Earth.
If we weren't as close or as far to the sun as we are, there'd be no life on Earth the way we know it.
Absolutely crucial. I mean, the temperature of water, the water is only liquid for at 1% of 1% of 1% of its temperature range. And yet on this planet, we've got the perfect temperature for water, and you can't have life without water. So if somebody said to me, I think God created all this, I could now say, have to say that as a lifelong agnostic, not an atheist, but certainly an agnostic, that I can't argue with that. If somebody says to me, I believe that people came from another galaxy who were far in advance, I'd say, well, I can't argue with that. I have difficulty, once we start looking outside of the Earth, thinking that it was a group that just got smart on the Earth. But there are other possibilities, which sound bizarre, but are actually entirely possible.
And they are?
Should I tell you?
Yeah.
In 2 years' time, there's going to be an experiment conducted in Switzerland at CERN, where they've got the circular accelerator. And they're expecting to demonstrate that it's possible to move backwards in time. Now, it may be that people
travelers
from the future go back to steer the past. Now, that sounds wacky, but it is absolutely squeaky clean science. Increasing numbers of physicists are talking seriously about it.
So they may have been the visitors that they talk about.
It could well be, because we designed ourselves, potentially, that people from the future go back to kickstart civilizations, because if they didn't, we would have never arrived at the point that we're at now, and the point that we will arrive at. So maybe we've skewed our own evolution. It sounds weird, but there is nothing wrong with the science. So that's a possibility.
Well, that's a darn good possibility.
Yeah, it stacks up, I'm afraid.
All right, let's go back to some more calls. First-time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I was calling because he had said a few things, that there was no religion or politics involved. Well, first of all, my grandfather was a Freemason. He died of a heart attack at 65.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
And, well, I never met him, so it wasn't too terribly personal, but, you know, I wish I had. Anyway, I know I've read a book as well, but it was short, it was concise, and it did seem to be a little biased. But it supported a lot of the things that the caller before said. Also, I've heard about an altar with many different books. You've talked about Osiris, the Egyptian all-seeing eye, the Osiris, the god of light or whatever. And you've also talked about Venus, and you've discounted Christianity a lot. I've also heard that the name of Christ cannot be used in a meeting. It seems that there are a lot of things which exclude Christianity alone and invite many other religions in. Seems to me a little biased against Christianity. I just wanted to know if you knew anything about the admission of Christ into the meetings. And also, I've heard of blood oaths at every level, as far as, like, you talked about the noose, and I've heard of, like, spears being put to people's chests, which seems to be fairly dark, even though, and, like, even ones where they swear that if they tell any of the secrets, they'll be split open across the belly and left for it to rot in the sun, and just horrible oaths. They could be totally, it could be totally biased, but I just wanted to know what your take was on that.
Okay, that's a fair enough question. The oaths that you refer to have, in some areas of Freemasonry, been removed because they are quite, as you rightly say, quite horrible. In sensible places, they've kept them in because they're just ancient. I mean, they're medieval. You know, people spoke in those sort of terms. So it's traditional and not inappropriate. It just comes from a time where that was normal. People always judge things in their own time frame and their own morality. You've got to look at it, because it's ancient, differently. So you're right, they do exist, but they're not acted out. In terms of the Christ not being mentioned, in some degrees, in the 33 degrees, Christ is the central character, and only Christians can be involved these days, which for me is a shame. Because the principle of Freemasonry is no religion should be mentioned, certainly any religion. And in Freemasonry we call God by different designations, but for instance, the great architect of the universe or the great geometrician of the universe, so that we're not offending Christians or Muslims or Jews or Hindus or anybody by picking on their particular name for God. Because God may have many names depending on your background, but there is still one God, the great architect of the universe. So it's not that Jesus Christ is excluded. There are some degrees where he's absolutely central. But in the primary degrees of Freemasonry, there is no religion directly referred to, and the content of the ritual is not in contradiction to anyone's religion. And throughout the ages, throughout the hundreds of years that Freemasonry existed, certainly in the United Kingdom, the powers that be in the church, the most senior people, including the King and the Archbishop of Canterbury, the primary Archbishop, have always been Freemasons. And clearly, if it was against Christianity, which was close to their heart, they would not have done it. So there isn't a collision. But it is just far older than Christianity. I mean, you can't criticize someone for not being a Christian before Jesus was born. So
I wonder if they did any dastardly deeds, Christopher, under the name or heading of Freemasonry.
No, I've looked into that, and the answer is no. There is no proven case of that. I mean, I'm sure there have been Freemasons that have committed murders. You know, there are bad guys
yeah.
as
individuals. But I mean, did they burn people to the stake as witches? And they said, we're Masons, and
no,
you're a witch?
No, quite the reverse. Freemasons were... that happened to Freemasons when the church, which is supposed to Christians. You know, when the Pope arrested the Knights Templar on Friday the 13th of October, Friday the 13th is always considered to be unlucky since then, in 1307, they tortured these priests, these monks, these Templars, by, for instance, burning their feet on braziers and then forcing them to crawl into court with the black bones from their feet in a box in front of them to confess to being heretics. Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master of the Templars, was burned at the stake by the Church, accused of being a heretic. They accused him of conducting weird rituals with homosexual acts and all sorts of terrible things. He denied the homosexual acts, but he didn't deny that the rituals were not Christian. He didn't attempt to deny that. And that's because he was conducting these rituals which are neutral. You know, they don't belong to any religion. They're a sort of acceptance of God without using any particular religion.
Excellent.
So the Church is attempting to destroy people who don't follow their particular interpretation over the years. But of course, we now live in more enlightened ages, and it does sound strange when you hear these terrible oaths about body parts being cut off if you give away secrets. But that's just an historical nicety. In the same way that the guys that guard Buckingham Palace in London here wear bright red uniforms and big busbies, but they don't go into battle like that anymore. They once did, but they keep them on for traditional purposes. It's the same with these oaths. They're just traditional, but they belong to a bygone age.
All right, let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Hi. I used to be a member of a secret society, and I can say, as your guest is saying, that I never saw any sacrifices or strange things going on, stuff like that. My question to you, Knight, is on the American dollar bill, the eye in the triangle, is that from a painting? Is that a particular person, do you know?
No, it is an ancient symbol called the Eye of Horus or by various other names. But it is just symbolic, I believe, of the all-seeing eye of God. In ancient Egypt, they believed that evil belonged to the night, but you couldn't escape the gaze of God because the sun itself was a manifestation of God that shone its light on you, and if you committed evil deeds, even in secrecy, God's light would find you out. His all-seeing eye would see the deed, so you can't hide. You have to face up to your actions. So it's a very healthy piece of symbolism that has been used in paintings and, as you say, on the dollar bill and in many places ever since, and adopted by various people, including Freemasons. And it's a positive symbol. People think it's anti-Christian because it doesn't belong in the church as such. But yet there are churches where it does appear. There are very old churches where it does appear. So whilst it's not a mainstream symbol, it is a symbol that has been used by Christianity for a long time. But the main symbols within Christianity are pre-Christian. So they're, you know, the symbols take on a power of their own. But they don't tend to belong to any one group.
Christopher, we've still got a whole bank of phone calls, and I know your time is pressed. Do you want to hang for another hour? What's your situation?
I could manage an hour if you need it, yeah.
All right, we'll go one more with you. Okay. I mean, they keep calling, and I don't want to just tell them goodbye and move on. I got to tell you, your theory of the possibility of time travelers just amazes me, though. That is shocking.
We're working on it at the minute because there's a lot more evidence that I can't talk about at the minute.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, really, really scary stuff. Not scary in the sense of threatening, but scary in the sense of
something has happened.
What it points towards.
Why would they come back if they did?
Well, that's only one theory. We're keeping entirely open on it. But assume that this experiment that's going to happen in 2 years' time goes well, and all scientists, physicists agree that there is no known reason why it should not work. If it does work, it's then quite possible to become masters of your own destiny by making sure you model what happened in the past.
Ah, okay, I see what you mean. Hold on, we'll be right back. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest Christopher Knight and, of course, your calls. So right before the break, Christopher, we talked about the possibility that maybe the time travelers, maybe them, is that possible?
It's a possibility, and more than a possibility, insofar as all of the other theories have got problems. That's the only theory that doesn't have a problem. But it's our belief, Alan Butler and myself, it's our belief that if that was to be true, there would be absolutely crystal clear messages, because there'd be no point doing it if you didn't prove that you'd done it. And that's what we're working on at the minute. If we can't find absolute, clear, hard evidence that will stand up in a court of law, we will not go for that theory. But we at the minute, it looks as though we may be onto the actual communication that suggests that. But it's a bit early to tell yet.
That could be fascinating.
Next year, I can probably tell you more.
Are there some prominent people who are still part of this organization of Freemasons?
No. Prominent people have tended to walk away.
They've got their own group, don't they? Skull and bones and other things.
No, Freemasonry is dying.
Is it really?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great pity that at the time when we now really understand where it has come from, that it should be dying. But it doesn't belong to this age. And really, it's created its purpose insofar as it did create civilization. I mean, the United States of America is particularly important because it was created absolutely on the principles of Freemasonry, of democracy, of the right of the individual, freedom of religion, which the Knights Templar absolutely believed in, and which was the ancient Egyptians believed in. And the freedom of science, they absolutely believed in that. And the whole sort of revolution that began in the 1700s and led those men to found the United States were driven by Masonic values, even if they were not all Freemasons. They were driven by those values, and they created a nation that was based on the freedom of the individual and the freedom of science to investigate, unencumbered by religion, remembering that the Roman Catholic Church used to stop people conducting scientific investigation. You know, Galileo was not allowed to say that the world was round, not flat. He was put under house arrest for saying such things. But now, thankfully, we separate those things out, and science is allowed to breathe, and people are allowed to vote, and that has all come courtesy of Freemasonry.
All right, let's go to the phones and get things going this hour. Our wild card line is up, and you are on. Hi there.
Hi. Yeah. My name's Heather. I'm calling from Tucson.
Hi, Heather.
I used to be very involved in Job's Daughters in Arizona until about a year ago. And while I was in it, I had the Masons who were, like, watching over us. They taught us about some of the ancient symbols, but there were also Christian symbols. And, I mean, some of the subgroups, like Eastern Star and Job's Daughters, are based on biblical stories, and there's a Bible in every lodge. When did Christianity kind of become a part of the organization?
Okay. In a Masonic lodge, the candidate that has been brought in, whether male or female, will take a vow on the volume of the sacred law, as it's called in Freemasonry, which is the Bible in the case of a Christian, which is the vast majority, but it can be any holy book, and it's referred to as the volume of the sacred law, and it's the one that applies to the individual. So that keeps the freedom of religion and the way you choose to worship God open to the candidate. But you will find in 99% or more than 99.9% of cases, that will automatically be the Christian Bible, of which, of course, there are thousands of different types of Bible. But it could be the one that applies to the candidate concerned.
Did you have a follow-up there, huh?
Yeah. Well, there's also, I mean, Eastern Stars is based on biblical stories, of the Bible is the story of Ruth, and Job's Daughters is based on the story of Job. And as far as I knew, from like around the world with that, and I know it's the girls' organization, but every Bethel had to, which is the group, the local one, had to have its own Bible that had signatures in it. And there weren't, you could be any religion, but there were no options other than the Bible. And there is a symbol on one of the walls that's like a large circle, and there's a little book at the top, and it's supposed to be like staying within the lines of morality, and the Bible is one of those symbols.
Well, the Bible would be one of those symbols, but of course the Bible is an ancient document. I mean, the Old Testament is obviously Jewish. The New Testament brought it into the Christian period. But the Bible was only really created about 600 BC, which makes it relatively recent. But the stories it contains are Sumerian in origin, Babylonian in origin. The Jews came out of Egypt. Their religion came out of Egypt. So I keep referring to this. There is a continuum over time of symbols and information and stories that take on new characters and new meanings at different points and different times. And so that... It's a living thing, but the rituals of Freemasonry, in actual fact, what they are the story of the Jewish people's relationship with God, their God, which of course is the Old Testament. But according to the Bible, it all stopped in around 70 AD, 70 to 100 AD, when the Gospels were written and St. Paul was alive, and then suddenly it stopped. But it didn't stop, because Freemasonic ritual kept on being written by the same people, the same priesthood. The same story continues. And so within Freemasonry, you'll find stories that are in the Bible, but the reason that they're the same or similar is because they are the same people that were recording it. But it didn't stop. The Bible did not stop where the New Testament finishes, because our man's relationship with God goes on. A lot of those rituals in Freemasonry are just recording that ongoing journey.
Do you think these possible revelations we've been talking about will know more than in about, what, 2 years, you say?
Yes. I think we'll know a lot more. We should be ready to publish our findings, which will be absolutely evidentially based, not theory-based. We think by less than 12 months.
And you think there'll be startling results based on what you think right now?
It's looking that way. Something may go wrong yet. For that theory, we don't mind what the outcome is. We're not, you know, trying to force any particular outcome. But at the minute, it's looking to say interesting is an understatement. But it needs to go further before we're ready to publish. But
will it shake the foundations of anything, Christopher?
Everything.
Really?
But I think it could change the way we look at the world fundamentally. Because obviously, even today, or more particularly today, we have the problem of collisions of religions, which have come from the same root, and yet they've gone so far apart that there are major collisions. And it's probably time to realize that those need to come back together again. And we need to understand the context of what we're doing, why we're doing it, and that just might be, it just may be, it's early yet, but it may be that we will have a definitive communication that we will be able to identify that will start to change the way we see the world.
Fascinating. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, I'm calling from Mississippi. I want to thank y'all for taking my call.
Sure.
And I actually have a couple of questions. I used to be a member of the Order of Demolay from the ages of 18 to 21, and I kind of got away from it because I noticed that a lot of the people that were in the Order were lazy and not too well educated, and a lot of the Master Masons that were overseeing us were kind of letting them get away with things in the lodges and stuff like that that they shouldn't have been getting away with, and I got away from it because of that. One question that I have is, how would you suggest I would go about becoming a Mason and finding someone that's a sponsor that would be worthy of teaching me?
Your point about being less than impressed by the Malay organization, which is for sons of Freemasons, basically, I think, and people who may become Freemasons. It only exists in the United States, so I don't know a great deal about it. But the failing of Freemasonry, as I say, is it's made up of people. If they were letting kids get away with things they shouldn't be getting away with, that wasn't too clever, and you walked away from it because it didn't impress you. Well, yeah, that's sorry to hear it, but these things happen. I walked away from Freemasonry for 10 years when I saw some bad behavior. Absolutely open racial prejudice, which I disapproved of completely.
By the organization or by some of the, just a
by
few of the members?
The individuals within it.
Yeah.
But they were in my lodge, and I didn't want any part of what they seemed to stand for.
I don't blame you.
They were going against the Masonic oath and not Masonic principles. And so you get bad people. But you get a disproportionate number of good people, I have to say. Now, as to your question, how you become a Freemason and get a good quality sponsor, there are a lot of truly good people in Freemasonry, and there really are. Even though I'm not a typical Freemason in that I'm as likely to criticize it as I am to praise it, everybody who becomes a Freemason has to go and ask. The idea that you'll be invited is wrong. You are not allowed to invite people, although, of course, it happens because people break the rules. You need to ask. So if you can go into a large building, you need somebody to sort of vouch for you. But if you start to make yourself known and that why you want to join, they will help you, I'm sure. And you will find that there are plenty of good people that will help you understand the positive side of Freemasonry, of which there is plenty.
Very good. Thanks for that phone call. Let's go to our international line. Where are you calling from?
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
This is George.
Yes.
Yes, and Christopher.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hi, this is Lyndon, and I'm calling from London, but in Canada.
Oh, Canada, okay.
Okay. First of all, to Christopher, I enjoy all your books, love. They're great.
Good.
And I'm looking forward to the new one and reading upon a subject which I know very little about, and it's always good to learn. But also what I'd like to say to the listeners of Coast to Coast, it's just a friendly reminder to exercise some caution and discrimination when considering the proliferation of urban myths and conspiracy theories, which are clearly provocative and entertaining. But if you go a little deeper and start to examine the mysteries of both ancient and contemporary mysteries, which are authentic, and you will find them, your listeners will find them much more compelling, illuminating, fascinating.
Then what?
The lighter fare, if you know what I mean.
No, I don't know what you mean.
You don't know what I mean.
No, but we'll move on. Just try to restrict your comments to Christopher, because we don't have that much time with him today. If you have general comments, that's what open lines are all about. He's to the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning, George. This is Steve in Jackson, Michigan.
Hi, Steve. Welcome.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask Christopher a very mundane question. I've always wondered why 41 out of 43 of our presidents have been sworn in by the Freemasons.
I think there's a lot of exaggeration goes on there. There are a lot of presidents who have been said to be Freemasons who in fact, weren't. So your first president certainly was, and there's been quite a few in between. But Freemasonry was the pillar of society. You know, if you didn't want to go down to the local bar where any old joke could get in, and you wanted that, being a group of people that were respectable and responsible, you joined your lodge. That was the idea, and it sort of worked. So people of influence and power tended to join Freemasonry. Today, they're more likely to join an upmarket golf club or something. So times have changed, but it's not surprising that the kings of England, the leaders of industry across the Western world have been disproportionately Freemasons. It's not surprising that a lot of presidents have been, but there are, as I say, there are a lot of claims for presidents being Freemasons, but they're just not true.
But it is an inordinate number, right?
Of course it is, yes, but it's not surprising because Freemasonry, the basis of Freemasonry was what created the United States. The whole idea of freedom of science and freedom of the individual is the engine of Freemasonry, and it's the engine of your country. So why would they not go to... It's like saying an inordinate number of presidents have been Christians. It's not surprising because Christianity is part of what your nation's about. I mean, it's about other religions too, but it's disproportionately about Christianity. So it's no more surprising to say we've had a lot of Christian presidents than it is to say we've had quite a lot of presidents who've been Freemasons.
Have the last five, six presidents been Freemasons, do you know?
Sorry?
Have the last five or six U.S. presidents been Freemasons?
No, I think not.
Bush,
I think I've heard that Ronald Reagan...
Bush,
was,
Clinton.
Was never active. Whether that's accurate or not, I don't know. But neither Bush's.
They were not. What about Bill
not.
Clinton?
Clinton, certainly not.
He was not.
No.
Okay.
So I think you've got to go back a little distance before. Certainly, LBJ was.
He was?
Yeah.
How about Kennedy?
No.
He was not.
No. So Freemasonry is dying, and its influence is dying because it doesn't have many influential people.
Is there some kind of sign, Christopher, where a Mason would know a Mason?
Yes, theoretically. But if there are various handshakes and other signs and symbols, and those are the bits that are secret. But they're really just traditional niceties. If somebody tried to give me a Masonic handshake, I'd think they were mad. You know, it's just something you use in a ritual. If someone did it in the real world, I would, I would think they were crazy.
Would you run from them?
Well, I would think this is a strange person.
You would, really?
Yeah. It's just not what you would do. I mean, if you greet someone in a Masonic lodge and you...
What kind of a handshake is it, for crying out loud?
Sorry?
What kind of a handshake is it?
Well, there's lots of different ones, depending on what degree you're talking about, but it's just inappropriate to use them in daily life. You use them in the symbolic temple where you meet. That's okay. I mean, some of them are quite strange. Some are very simple, and you'd hardly notice them. But they are just traditional things and symbolic things. I mean, you can recognize Freemasons by their choice of words to some extent, supposedly by certain stances. But you would look crazy to actually try and use them. The anti-Mason lobbies say that people accused in court give Masonic symbols to the judge and then they're mysteriously let off. You know, it's absolute nonsense.
Okay, stay with us, Christopher. We'll be back with you in some final phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Jordan. And welcome back to our final segment with our guest, Christopher Knight, and, of course, the rest of your phone calls. Christopher, what do you do next in terms of in between now and the next couple of years when the experiment is underway?
Well, our research continues. We're not putting everything onto that theory. We've got to look... equally and even-handedly at all the possibilities of who these people were. Admittedly, that's a very important element, but we want hard evidence, not theories. So we're just continuing to research and to dig.
All right, let's go back to the calls. Who is up next? Let's go to our West of the Rockies line. Hi there. Hello.
Hi, George.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Jerry in Scottsdale.
Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Christopher, thank you. This has been a great conversation tonight. I can't wait to get your book. My question has to do with the symbols of the Star of David, and then as it changed over to the current G with the compass on it. Have you ever made any connection between those and any measurements with the pyramids or how the pyramids were designed?
Well, if we can deal with your last part first. That has fallen. That's in the new book, Civilization One. Accidentally came out of the research. It was spotted in the 1850s that the Great Pyramid, for instance, at Giza, the Khufu Pyramid, appears to exhibit rather accurately the ratio of pi. And we found out exactly why, because the Egyptian units of measurement were the remen and the cubit, which are actually, if you have a square and you put a diagonal across it, and one side of the square is a cubit, the diagonal will be a remen. But if you put a circle around the circle is a megalithic yard, the unit of measurement that was used in the British Isles 5,000 or 6,000 years ago that Professor Tom found. So it looks like the Egyptians took a circle from the British Isles, the Stone Age, and put a square inside it to produce their own units of measurement, which they then created the pyramids with. But they actually used the wheel to measure out the length of the sides and then took the height of the wheel to make the height. And quite accidentally, in using that process, the ratio of pi appears in those pyramids. Because they use that technique, as people use today for measuring out distances on roads, they use wheels.
Right.
But they used a megalithic yard circumference, which gave them a diameter of a remen. So the fact that those pyramids do exhibit pi is not surprising, the pi being the relationship of the circumference to the diameter of a circle. So the design of the pyramids has fallen out of this, and strangely, they're using this Stone Age measure as their basis. The symbol of the Star of David is a very ancient symbol, which of course is two pyramids, one pointing down, one pointing up, which I believe to be simply the pyramid on earth with the flat base pointing towards heaven and heaven pointing down towards the earth, the other pyramid pointing down, with the ancient principle of as above, so below. So they look to the heavens. What happened in the heavens happened on the earth, which has come through many, many cultures. So that so-called Star of David, which actually is not a Jewish symbol. It was a Christian symbol long before the Jews adopted it. They only adopted that around 1,000 years ago from the Knights Templar churches. They thought that's a great symbol. I think we'll use that. So it isn't. It was first used in any quantity. If you like,
right.
Made popular by Christians.
George, one other thing, if I could, I wanted to give you an answer to one of your questions.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at John Robinson's book, Born in Blood, and in the beginning of the 25th chapter, it says that on February 11, 1988, high-ranking Freemasons met with Ronald Reagan in the Oval Office and made him an honorary member of the Scottish Rite Mason.
Ah, okay.
All right, and Christopher, again, I can't wait to get your book and read it as well.
Great, I hope you enjoy that.
Okay.
Thank you.
I appreciate you being part of the program. One of our listeners writes in, Christopher, and says that there were 15 presidents.
15? That sounds a pretty accurate figure.
Yeah,
I would guess.
That's less than half
yeah.
of what we've had.
Yeah.
But that's still a high number.
It is, but it as I say, how many were Christians?
Probably all of them.
Yeah, 100%. To different degrees, I guess. But
I don't connotate religion with organizations or memberships. To me, that's different. To you, I guess not.
To me, no, not at all. It is an organization just the same. When you say you're a Christian, you're subscribing to some beliefs and some values. When you say you're a Freemason, you're subscribing to some beliefs and some values, which are, in many ways are very similar to Christianity, but it's just the same thing.
All right, thanks for that. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Christopher, I happen to be a Masonic daughter, granddaughter, niece, and I also happen to be a niece to an Eastern Star.
Right.
I can't believe the ideas some of these people have. I grew up with it. I went to Shriners picnics, and if you've never been to a Shriners picnic, you don't know what a picnic is. I know that there were so many of my friends who wanted to know why my dad was a Mason, and I found the only ones that didn't understand it were of Catholic faith. And the Masons are Jews. They're Christians of all different denominations. Their only religion that's not in the Masons is the Catholic, and that's because the Catholics, going way back when, objected to the Masons. It's not the Masons objected to them.
Of course, yeah, that's correct. But what you say is true. The Masons can. There are many, many Catholics, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, possibly, of Catholics who are Freemasons. There is absolutely no ban on anybody who believes in God becoming a Freemason. Certainly, the Catholic Church has been against Freemasonry. But having said that, I'm reliably informed that many popes, recent popes, have been Freemasons. So what you see on the surface is not necessarily what happens underneath.
I have one question I'd like to ask you, though. As you know, the ring and insignia is a square, a compass, and the letter G. From what I understand, the G stands for three words. One's God, one's geometry. What is the third one?
I don't know the answer to that. I have only ever been given the understanding that it's God, or the great architect of the universe. Certainly, God and geometry and architecture are all considered to be one of the same thing. The entity that created everything. So the G is just bundles up all of those values, and in the simplest word, it is God. Obviously, people can, when you have a symbol, people can attribute different things to it. I've never heard the three things that in any ritual I've heard, it has never been explained that way. It is always explained that the G represents God.
Why do they deal with so many symbols, Christopher?
Well, symbols have always been incredibly important. Obviously, they almost take on a magical, particularly in the Middle Ages, take on a magical nature. But, I mean, the five-pointed star, for instance, is often, you know, associated with witchcraft, and pentangle is, you know, mystic. But it's actually the pattern of that Venus forms as it moves around the Earth. So, I mean, there are usually astronomical ideas behind these symbols. And symbols become important because in a time when people weren't educated and there wasn't an internet to have a flow of knowledge everywhere, and there weren't even books available and people couldn't read anyway, you needed symbols to package ideas. I mean, you know, Christianity, the cross or the fish, you know, they're incredibly powerful symbols, which are far more ancient than Christianity, but have been used, and symbols have to carry this power. How do you say in a word, you know, if you're a deeply Christian person, wearing the cross around your neck, for instance, says it all for you. It packages it all up rather neatly. That's all symbols do.
Well, at least it's supposed to. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
And thank you, George, very much for having this program.
You are welcome.
I've enjoyed listening to it for quite a while, you and Art both.
Well, you know, it's different. I've had so much response about this and Freemasonry. I thought, you know, let's at least get someone on who knows a little bit more than we do about this.
Well, I can tell you that Christopher definitely knows what he's talking about.
Okay.
Christopher, what? I've got a couple of comments, but then I got some questions also, Art. George. Christopher, what was the highest office that you've held in Lodge?
I am a basic third-degree Freemason.
Okay, so
always you're insisted upon staying exactly that.
Okay, you didn't hold an office in Lodge then?
I've held offices in the Lodge, yeah. But I've absolutely stopped short of being Worshipful Master of a Lodge.
Okay. Reason I asked, right? So far, the highest I've held was in the West.
Yeah.
But the 30, you had a couple comments regarding the 32nd degree Mason you and George were talking, and the only difference really between the 32nd degree and the first 3 degrees, once you get the first 3 degrees, you're a master Mason, period. Everybody has to start from there. And to get your 32nd degree, it's just more education that you take pertaining to Masonry.
Well, I disagree with that a little bit.
Well,
most of those degrees are conferred in name only these days. You're not even allowed to see the ritual.
How many different classes of degrees do they have anyway?
There's 33 as the top.
I mean, so it goes from what?
Right.
From 33 down to 1?
Yeah, your first degree is your entered apprentice.
I see. Okay. And Christopher, you said your 3rd degree or 33rd degree?
I think he said 3rd.
Christopher, are you with us?
Yes. There are, according to formalized craft Freemasonry, in England, there are only 3 degrees. The rest are not considered to be absolutely genuine and real, if you like. And
oh, yeah,
Scottish Rite, there are 33 degrees. In the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim, there are 96 degrees. So there are an awful lot of degrees in different parts, but the first 1, 2, and 3, particularly the 1st and 3rd, are the most important.
But if you're number 3, somebody's at 33. That's a big difference, isn't it?
Yes, but it isn't considered to be really Freemasonry. These are sort of bolt-on add-ons, and what they've actually done is create rituals around bits and pieces of all sections of ritual. They're not meaningful. And they're jumped. You jump up to like to the 18th and jump to the 32nd. And I know people who have become 32nd degree Freemasons, which happens automatically in the United States. It's, you know, any dimwit gets there in no time. You know, I'm not being rude to them, but they know nothing. It is not meaningful because they're not even allowed to see the rituals that they are supposedly members of. They can ask, and they might be refused. I've seen all the rituals, but they're not commonly available, and they're not particularly special. There is no knowledge imparted because it's all codified anyway. You need to really understand the whole context before any of it has any meaning.
All right, next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hi, this is Edie from Wisconsin.
Edie, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well. Live long and prosper, George. Christopher, I have a wonderful little story that is kind of neat, and there are no coincidences, right, George?
You got that right.
I brought the dresser home from my grandfather. He passed away, and grandmother has passed away quite a long time ago. And this dresser was very Art Deco-ish, and a lot of compartments and a lot of big drawers, and most of the stuff was cleaned out. And lo and behold, I found a wallet that must be from maybe 1930s with the Mason symbol on it. And I'm wondering, Christopher, in the center, I think you did talk about this to the previous caller, there is a G in the center. This is an old wallet. I can barely make it out. But this is so neat that I'm holding it in my hands as we speak, and it has this G in the center. And on the other side, I don't know if it's from a crease or maybe it was burnt or something, there is like a sort of a diagonal line from the outside of the compass going through the G, and it's extending outward to the other side, and it's on an angle. Could you maybe tell me about that? Because this would give me great peace of mind about my grandfather, and also that he led a secret life. No one knew, George, that he was a Mason.
Huh.
No one knew. And all those nights that he was going out to his poker games, guess where he was going?
To the lodge.
To the lodge. Could you touch on that question, Christopher, and I'll get off the phone. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay. I think that sounds like it is a crease in the wallet. The sort of most fundamental symbol of Freemasonry is the compasses, the square and compasses, with the G in the center. As I say, the G representing God or the great geometrician of the universe, because the square and compasses are the basic building tools, the sort of dividers for measuring, and the right angle for creating uprights, which are analogous to the individual building themselves strong and upright, and living an upright life. So the square and compasses with the G in it is the symbol you would expect to see on the front of something like a wallet or on a ring or something of that nature, or a lapel pin. But the line that's going off at an angle, I think that's probably just something that's happened to the wallet, I'm afraid.
Time-wise, Christopher, when do you think you might have a little bit more data about what could be the startling revelation of time travelers?
Within the year.
That close?
That close, really.
Like within the next few months, then, or a 12-month calendar?
There are things that are going to take us a little bit of time, but we are hoping by sort of next summer we will have cracked those and be able to write them up and talk about them towards the end of next summer.
I love stories that shake the foundation of things.
Well, I think this is going to be a sort of 11 on the Richter scale. It's really going to shake things.
This is amazing. Is anybody else working on this, or just you and your partner, Robert?
There's just myself and my partner, Alan Butler, in this case.
Oh, Alan Butler on this
yeah.
one. Okay.
We don't know, obviously, what other people may be doing, but we've got information that is not generally available.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. I can't wait to hear it when that comes out. Thank you so much, Christopher. Appreciate you being on the program.
My pleasure, George. Good to be with
you. His book is Civilization One. His website is civilizationone.com. Thank you. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Christopher Guinness, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie.